We closed last week's episode reading through the salient points of Beethoven's Heiligenstadt will. To the long document there was also a postscript which began with words of farewell. Here Beethoven appeals to Providence and refers to this world as to the temple of mankind. His are clearly the thoughts of a liberal thinker, reflecting the guidance he had received from his teacher and mentor, Christian Neefer, the Freemason, the believer in the brotherhood of man. The Heiligenstadt will is almost a suicide letter, written by a believer whose religion is a blend of the concepts of the Enlightenment and also of Oriental thought. On completing the document, Beethoven folded it across the center and then lengthwise to no wider than an envelope. He then hid it and kept it with him for the rest of his life, never showing it to anyone, never taking legal advice over it. As he moved house in Vienna and its surroundings countless times, the Heiligenstadt will and his grandfather's portrait always came with him. Various authors agree that this document marks a cathartic moment in Beethoven's life. I read in James Hamilton Patterson's Symphonia Eroica, in some way the Heiligenstadt crisis must have been cathartic because his truly Promethean creativity never flagged. Beethoven at last acknowledges his deafness. He decides not to hide it any further and to continue his life notwithstanding. he does not put an end to his life, in fact declaring, "Ah, it seemed impossible to leave this world until I had produced everything I felt capable of, and so I carried on my miserable existence." He would now enter the most prolific period of his life. The following 10 years would be his heroic phase. He will enter what he calls his new way, and like Prometheus, who is continually tormented, he will live with his torment and yet produce all that he was capable of until his death, about 25 years later. A couple of years before his Heiligenstadt period, he had been asked to write the music for a ballet called The Creatures of Prometheus. The Titan Prometheus was to be an inspiration, a heroic model for our genial musician, who will free himself from the constraints of the 18th century music and create something new that will change music forever. At this point in the story, I would like to make a brief deviation and talk about the fascination that classic antiquity had on intellectuals of the 18th and early 19th century. This was sparked by the discovery of Ercolano and Pompeii in the mid-18th century, and as a consequence of the archaeological findings of the German Johann Joachim Winckelmann, who in 1764, in his History of the Art of Antiquity, indicated the Athenian sculptures of Phidias, Praxiteles, and Lysippus as expressing the universally valid model of beauty, the universal humanity, expressed in the natural harmony of the human figure. Winckelmann's writings awakened a passion for the classic past that still enlivens the Western cultural imagination. This, and the discovery of the classic culture of ancient Greece by intellectuals traveling on the Grand Tour, indicated Plutarch's opposition to any form of absolutism as a model and opened the minds to the idea of republican virtue, the aspiration for freedom and for high moral values in politics. This aspiration for the neoclassic, which looked to order, to harmony, and to the control of passions, was in line with the artistic and political dimension of the Enlightenment, of the French Revolution, and the fall of the Ancien Régime. Poets and thinkers drew inspiration from the myths and heroes of the ancient past. Byron, Keats, and Shelley come to mind. In Berlin, the Schlegel brothers, August Wilhelm and Friedrich, founded the publication Athenaeum, while in England, William Wordsworth and Samuel Taylor Coleridge published the Lyrical Ballads. Thank you. In 1820, Percy Shelley publishes Prometheus Unbound, based on the Greek myth of the Titan Prometheus, who tricks Zeus and steals fire to donate it to humanity. This fire will make life more amenable for humans, as it will provide warmth and light. In so doing, Prometheus has angered Zeus, who subjects him to eternal torment by tethering him to a stake on Mount Caucasus, where an eagle is set to feed upon his ever-regenerating liver. The ancient Greek language and literature started to be taught in schools in Germany, and like the intellectuals of his time, Beethoven too took inspiration from classical myths. In Prometheus, this Titan who, while enduring torment, persisted in his way, Beethoven may have seen himself enduring the torment of his deafness, yet persisting because he believed in his talent and felt that he still had so much to give to his divine art. I read from James Hamilton Patterson's Sinfonia Ironica that when Beethoven was asked in 1800 to write the orchestral music of this ballet called The Creatures of Prometheus, he probably welcomed the commission, as it was for the Vienna's Burgtheater, and it was to be designed by the famous ballet master Salvatore Viganò. But as he worked on the Promethean myth, the eternally suffering hero must have suggested striking parallels with his own predicament, and even with his idealized but inconsistent identification with Napoleon Bonaparte. Was not Napoleon a bringer of freedom's fire as a gift to mankind? The ballet was not a great success, but Beethoven used and reused the taxing variations as a kind of trial run for the Eroica Symphony's finale. So, in the amenable surroundings of Heiligenstadt, a dramatic change happened. And, in some way, the Heiligenstadt crisis must have been cathartic because his truly Promethean creativity never flagged. Thank you. When he returned to Vienna, he told his pupil Czerny that he was not satisfied with the work that he had done so far, declaring, "From this day I shall take a new way." I read in John Suchet's biography of Beethoven, "And take a new way he most certainly did." He was about to embark on the richest period of his life, when the works that flowed from him were not just new and different, but unlike anything any composer had written before. Yes, this was to be Beethoven's heroic period. Soon after Beethoven's return to Vienna, towards the end of 1802, his brother Karl came over to Vienna and began to act as his secretary. The relationship between brothers was always rather difficult, and this arrangement was to have its hitches. While Karl acted as his secretary, Beethoven was appointed composer in residence of the Theater an der Wien. Although not under imperial administration, this was the most important among a large number of independent theaters in Vienna. It was situated outside the Bastille, the city wall. It was new and innovative, and frequented by the bourgeoisie. The owners were a businessman and an eccentric artistic director, Emanuel Schikaneder, who engaged Beethoven on the premise that he would write the music for an opera. The job came with lodgings, so Brother Karl moved in to live with Beethoven. But whatever fraternal tension there may have been in the small apartment in the Theater an der Wien, there was no stopping Beethoven's creativity. This was the time when he organized a benefit concert on the 5th April 1803 in the Theater an der Wien, during which he presented, as part of a very ambitious and lengthy concert, the Christ on the Mount of Olives, his first symphony, the premiere of his second symphony, and the premiere of his third piano concerto. This was also the time when there was a brief collaboration with George Bridgewater, a violinist, son of an African father and a Polish mother. The two musicians were introduced to one another by Prince Lichnowsky. Beethoven composed a violin sonata, which Bridgewater and he presented on 22nd May 1803. The concert made history for the improvisations which saw the two virtuosi vying with one another. Bridgewater watched Beethoven's fingers fly up and down the keyboard, and then he fixed his violin under his chin and imitated the sound on the violin. Beethoven was astounded, and quite unexpectedly he ran across to hug the violinist and insisted that Bridgewater repeated the exercise. So pleased was Beethoven that he decided to dedicate the sonata to his newly acquired colleague. It seemed that the two were on to a jovial and lasting collaboration. But Beethoven, his unpredictable character, ruined this friendship when Bridgewater made the mistake of his life, passing an unpleasant remark about a lady. This Beethoven considered unforgivable, and no matter how much Bridgewater pleaded and tried to explain that no offense was meant, the friendship was ruined and the dedication withdrawn. Beethoven sent the manuscript with a dedication to a French violinist living in Paris. This was Rudolf Kreutzer, who on receiving it exclaimed, "C'est impossible, c'est la musique du diable, on ne peut pas la jouer." And he never did. Kreutzer never performed in public the sonata that bears his name, the greatest violin sonata ever written, the Kreutzer Sonata. But time was ripe for the Third Symphony, the Eroica, of which we have amply spoken in this and the previous episodes. In next week's episode, I shall look at the work which Beethoven had pledged to write for the Theater an der Wien, an opera based on Jean-Nicolas Bouilly's play, Léonore ou l'amour conjugal. Beethoven seems to have desired amour conjugal all his life, so this may also be the opportunity to take a look at Beethoven's personal life, his friends, infatuations, and love stories.